everyone who's come out on this fine day. A little rainy, but glad everybody's here. If you're visiting, we're really glad you're here. I hope we make you feel welcome and you'll want to come back and be with us often. Couple of quick things that I'm going to mention before I get into the lesson this morning. One is Wes is, as was said, James, or Edward said earlier, Wes is visiting. He's actually preaching where I preached for so long before I came here. So I trust they will do well with each other, and we'll look forward to Wes getting back. Also, if there are several events, and I put a new upcoming events on the bulletin board. Movie night, Carteret Park, several things like that are on there. So for more details, please go to that. And also, I want to join with Jeremy and others wishing everyone here a happy Mother's Day. All of you mothers, anyway, a happy Mother's Day. And I hope and trust that those of your loved ones will make you feel great today. It seems like there was one other thing I wanted to mention. Maybe not. Maybe that's it. So, let me get right into the lesson. Over the next couple of sermons in this quarter, as we're talking about building an ark, and we are talking about building an ark at home, I want us to talk about the actual home, the home itself. I want us to look at, and I'm going to start with by talking about an old-fashioned home. We'll talk about what that is and what that means, and then I'm going to kind of dig a little deeper into that and look at maybe some specific roles and duties and responsibilities and that kind of thing that will, in fact, in turn, create an old-fashioned home. And when we're saying old-fashioned, you know that I'm probably going to say old-fashioned means according to the way God fashioned it in the Bible. So let's get right into that and talk about it. Ideally, if we have a godly home, and that's what we want to have, that's what we want to talk about, a godly home is an ark. We looked last time, and Jeremy read the passage again that I've been stressing, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. A godly home, serving God, is fashioned according to God's plan. Now, there are a lot of different ideas about what makes a good home, a successful home, and all of that kind of thing. There are many books that you can, and in fact, a myriad of books that you can go out there and buy and read. A ton of material on the internet that you can read. Many seminars and classes and all of that kind of thing that you can attend. And there will be about as many different ideas of what makes a godly home, or rather, not a godly home, but what makes a successful home. But I want to talk about a godly home fashioned according to God's plan, an old-fashioned home, and I want to suggest to you that this is how that home looks on the foundation of it. It starts with a man who is, if you'll notice in the box, very importantly, a husband and a father. If there is going to be a home, and especially if there's going to be children, and I'm talking about that, if there is going to be such, if we are going to build an ark that we will be able, as the song says, to save our sons and our daughters, there's going to be a man, and he is going to accept the dual responsibility of being husband and father, and those two are inseparable in a home with children. There's going to be likewise a woman who accepts the responsibilities of being both a wife and a mother. And this is where a godly home begins, when a man who intends to be a husband and father is bound by God to a woman who intends to be a wife and a mother. And if you'll turn to Romans chapter 7, you will see in verses 2 and 3 that very clearly, regardless of where the world might be on this, very clearly, when a man and a woman are bound by God together, when they marry, and I've said already from up here, we have several couples that are marrying this very year among us here. And so when a man and woman marry, they are bound by God. It is a holy union in the sight of God, when they have a right to do so, of course, and they are bound to one another, as this passage says, as long as they live. The woman is bound by the law of God, to her husband so long as he lives. And if she were to leave her husband and be married to another, that's not the lesson this morning, but it certainly factors into the lesson. If she were to do that, she would be committing adultery, and vice versa, the same with the man. Again, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, you can see the same terminology down in verse 39 of being bound. But I want you to turn to 1 Corinthians 7 for a moment. As I say, this is not a lesson so much about divorce and remarriage, and I think that all of us understand. If we're going to have a godly home, an old-fashioned home, it is not going to be a home that is racked with divorce and remarriage and all of that kind of thing. It is going to be a commitment and a lifetime commitment. Children are going to grow up understanding this man who is my father is the husband of my mother and will be until one of them dies. This woman who is my mother will be the wife of this man until one of them dies. They will grow up and they won't understand that when they first come into this world, but they will grow to understand that. And they will see this bond as it is practiced between a man and a woman, and they will understand that it is an unbroken, inseparable bond. That these two people believe they are bound by God as long as they both live. And so they will see things between the man and the woman. The man and the woman won't be perfect. And they'll have their problems like everybody else in the world has. And they may even witness disagreements. They may even witness arguments, at least that begin, between a man and a woman. But they will come quickly to understand that that doesn't mean these two are breaking up my home. I don't know where I'm going to be next week or next year. They won't have that feeling. Some of us know very well that feeling. But these children won't have that. No, these two people, they'll be human beings, and just like me, they'll have disagreements and all of that kind of thing, but they'll work it out because they're bound by God. When you look at 1 Corinthians 7, really that's what Paul is teaching in a very metropolitan world of his day. A world that I want you to understand, a world that was given to fornication, was given to affairs, to cheating, much like our world, if not worse. So much so in Corinth that a very synonym in Paul's day for committing fornication was to Corinthianize. It just was a way of life. And that people did not stay married and bound to one another as Paul is describing here. In fact, they divorced for any and every reason and Roman law allowed it. I have over in my library someone going back and translating an ancient text from this day in which a woman married and divorced 7 times. But I want you to understand, she married and divorced 7 times in one day. Yeah, people saying, what? How do you even do that? Roman law allowed divorce for any reason, and it had gone to extremes in Paul's day. So when he writes what he writes in 1 Corinthians 7, you can understand. Someone had written, apparently, and questioned Paul, is it just better to, chuck off the whole idea of marriage? Is it good for a man to not even touch a woman? Just be celibate. If you're going to be a Christian, just forget the whole marriage, the whole relationship thing, and be totally separate from that. Kind of like living like a monk or a nun. Paul said, no, that's not what God intended. Read with me the opening verses. Now concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication. I would suspect that in Paul's day, when Paul wrote to these people, the idea of avoiding fornication was even more laughable than it probably is to our world today. Paul said, no, to avoid fornication. Let every man have his own wife. You see that here, as I pictured it. Let every woman have her own husband. Let the husband, verse 3, an idea that may be foreign. The whole idea of, domestic violence and on and on and on it goes in our day. But that the husband render unto the wife due benevolence. What does that mean? It means that the husband treat the wife with the good she deserves. And likewise, the wife, do the same for the husband. When two people are married, it's a relationship. It's a work in progress. You grow closer. closer to each other. I had someone, a young lady that asked me a few weeks back, a young couple. And Montel and I were sitting there at the table and we were eating with them. And this young lady said, you know, we were talking about the fact we've been married, it's coming up here in a few days, 21 years. How do you do that? She said. And I kind of laughed and I said, well, you know, you have problems like everybody else. You fight it out, you go on, you're married. And then we talked about it. And I made the point, you know, Montel and I aren't perfect. When you look around the room and you see people who have been married for a long time, they're not perfect human beings. A little angel didn't come down from heaven with a wand and say, bing, have a good marriage. Doesn't work that way. But when you're good to your wife, or the wife is good to her husband, there's far too little good in people that treat you well in this life, so why wouldn't you want to perpetuate that? Kids grow up in a home where they look at mom and dad who treat each other like they should, with respect and love, and that person is first in their lives. What a novel idea for a marriage, right? And yet Paul is saying that. And Paul even goes on to say in verse 4, you know, this idea of I'm my own person and I totally control me and nobody has any say. Well, that's not true in marriage. No, he says, the wife does not have power of her own body. The idea is she doesn't have right over herself. She gave herself to her husband. And the husband doesn't have right over himself. He gave himself to his wife. And those two were bound by God, so much so that God would refer to them as one person. Kids need that. They need to see that. They need to know that. They need that security. And if we are going to have a godly home that becomes an ark where they can be saved as they come into that home and grow up in that home, then they're going to have to see that out of mom and dad. When you look at this passage, and I won't go all the way through 1 Corinthians 7, but when you see it, it is the idea of sticking with and staying with and not leaving and not going to the next one and the next one and the next one. There are jokes made about that. Jokes made about, you know, actors and so forth, and we all know them, where he keeps trading her in for a younger model, you know. Looks just the same as the one used to look 20 years ago, but now traded in for a younger. Those are jokes that are made, but that's not what we do. No, we come into this marriage believing that God's plan was for life. I want you to go back with me to the book of Genesis. I'll say something else about this home. I realize that there are a lot of different pictures of an acceptable home today. But God's picture begins in Genesis 1. On the sixth day of creation, the last thing that God created was man. It is the highest of his creation on earth, without question. It is the only thing made in the very image of God, and we see that in verse 26. Read it together with me. God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the fowl of the air, the cattle, over all the earth, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. But I want you to look at that in the very image of God. Ask yourself this question. If God approached us like most people approach marriage, where would we be? You know, if there wasn't the commitment and the love and the sacrifice and all of those things, we could go on and on, that God does toward us, we are in the very image of God. If he approached us like we approach marriage, just in general, without the obvious exceptions, where would we be? But God did create, verse 27. He created man, human beings, in his own image. In the image of God created he him. And then I want you to notice at the end of verse 27, he distinctly made them male and female. Now we live in a time where that distinction between males and females has been lost to a great degree. And I don't mean just in the operations where someone has a quote-unquote sex change or they move from one gender, quote-unquote, to another. And I'm not even talking about all of that. I'm talking about the idea of a man being get into more of that next Sunday. But I'm talking about the idea of, well, I said next Sunday, I think it's 2 weeks. Anyway, I'll get into that. But the idea is of a man who wants to be a man, a male, who wants to be a male. And as he accepts his role in a family of being a husband and a father, those are distinctly male roles. And again, with the woman who wants to be a woman, she wants to be a wife. And she wants to be a mother. And the children have this clear picture in their mind. And I mean almost from birth. This is my dad. This is my mom. This is what my dad does. This is what my mom does. This is how my dad sounds. This is how... They learn all of that. And it is a good thing. Because God made them male and female. And God intended a home, barring unforeseen circumstances like the death of a spouse, it happens. But barring that, this was God's one and only plan for a home. It wasn't all of these different arrangements and so forth and so on, these communal arrangements, these arrangements with, you know, four or five people are your parent, and on it goes. Or two of this gender, or two of that gender, or three and one, or whatever it is. God never intended all that. Male and female, He created them. And He blessed them, a male and a female. Notice verse 28. He blessed them, and He said, "Be fruitful, and multiply, and replenish, or fill up the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion, of course, over every living thing." God created this institution. If we went into chapter 2, of course, you can go down to verse 18. It is not good for man to be left alone. I will create him a woman, obviously, who is a help meet for him. Now, not a help meet, okay? But a help that is meet, that is suitable, that is fit to him. In other words, these are two counterparts. They're two parts of the whole. When He brought Eve to Adam and he married them. I often joke with young couples when I'm, you know, counseling before marriage or whatever, and I say, "Well, you know, the guy that did the first wedding." And they're like, "No. Well, that was God." You know, God married the first two. And when He did, He brought them, in verse 24, "A man will leave his father and his mother and cleave." Be joined. Glued is the idea to his wife. And they were both naked, verse 25, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed. This is an honorable arrangement. It's an honorable institution. And you know, children benefit greatly from that. When you see children and know, if you have any, and it's sad, but in this day you have to say it like that. You know, when a lot of us were younger, some of us were sitting around, I think James was making the comment Friday night, and talking about how when he was a child, now if we go back 30 years plus, me, you go back 50 years, you know, you start getting in a time when you were a child and homes looked like this. Everybody had a mom and everybody had a dad. I mean, occasionally, you know, someone's father had died in the war or whatever it might be, that kind of thing. But people had a mom and a dad. And this is what they thought of as a home. And when you describe your home life, oh, you talked about the usual things, you know, your parents made you go to bed at such and such a time. We thought we had it so bad. Man, have you heard the discussions of kids today? It's incredible. Just normal activity. My dad gets drunk and beats up my mom. Normal. Man, if we were kids and someone said, "My dad gets drunk and beats up my mom," we would go, "Whoa, what is that?" But that's the common. When they describe mom and dad, they describe two different people who live in two different states and they visit one or the other, live with one or the other for a certain amount of time. That's normal. God never intended that. God intended this stable, secure environment. And if we are going to build an ark to save our sons and our daughters, this is what we are going to work for. This is what we're going to strive for. This, we are not going to be like the Corinthians and say it would be better if none of us ever married. That's not what God wanted. Oh, there are exceptions to that, of course. But I'm saying in general, God never wanted that. No, He wanted people to marry. You can see it in the very creation. And fill up the earth with people. But He wanted them filled up with children who had a chance. They had learned how to be godly people. They had learned what it means to have a godly home. That's what He wanted. And that's what He still wants. And nothing short of that. An old-fashioned home. So what is it? What is an old-fashioned home? What does it look like? Well, it looks like what we just described. But there are many, many other things to say, aren't there? It has to do with how you treat each other. It has to do with the respect you have for each other. You know, when you see God describing husbands and wives, you always see terms of commitment. You see terms of honor. You know, she's the weaker vessel. I hate what's been done with that translation and that idea. It doesn't just mean that a big man can hit her and break her apart. No, the word has to do with something that's precious, valuable. You know, we have a few little things in our home that are very fragile. And when you touch them, and when you carry them from one place to another, you've got to be a little extra careful, because they break easily. That's what He was saying there. So you treat it with honor and respect. And the wife, see that she, Ephesians 5, reverence her husband. I want to look at some of those phrases and ideas. But that's what an old-fashioned home looks like. How does it differ from the new modern home? You know, you're almost inclined to say, in absolutely every respect, it differs. Oh, every once in a while, out in the world, you find that kind of home. Every once in a while, out in the world, you actually see two people married for 50, 60, 70 years, and they love each other, and they treat each other well. Regardless of what you felt about President Bush, the first one, you know, his wife died couple of weeks back, and they had been married, memory serves, 73 years. Yeah. And apparently they married very young. They said everything was against them when they first married because they married too young. But they stayed married 73 years, and even into their 90s, he had a practice. He called her Barbie, you know, Barbara Bush. And he had a practice where the last thing he would say before they went to sleep was, "I love you, Barbie." And someone was commenting on that and making the point that tonight, for the first time in 73 years, George won't be able to say, "I love you, Barbie." We see that occasionally, rarely. And I'll tell you, in the 40 years I've been preaching, it's getting rarer still, even within the Lord's church. But when you see it, you know it's different. When kids see it, when they come into your home, especially if they come from all the kinds of homes we've been talking about, and they come into your home and they see your mom and your dad, they know it's different. And they will comment almost immediately of how different it is. And they never speak of it in terms that the world, we adults would speak of. We would talk about, "That's weird, you know, that's ridiculous. You can't have that." They never speak of it like that. They speak of it in envy. They want it. They wish they had it. It's something that appeals to children, because naturally they were created to have it. You can easily acknowledge the breakdown of the home in our society. I've said this several times all during this year. There's no question that statistically, there are not many children growing up in that home we just described, that traditional, classical, old-fashioned, biblical home of father and mother in their roles, doing what they're supposed to be doing as mom and dad. And the idea of an extended family, where grandparents get to be grandparents. You know? Where uncles and aunts are not having to do the surrogate job, they get to be aunts and uncles. And all of that support, all of that reinforcing, that basic idea of these children being trained up in the way they should go. There are very few children who have that. And so I ask you, is there real value in a home fashioned in this manner? I want to tell you a little story before I close out. I got another point I want to make here on the slide, and we'll introduce the next lesson, but I won't spend much time. When Montel and I were going to marry, of course, you guys know my story, so you know that, you know, it's not all of this that I'm preaching. I wish it were. But when Montel and I were going to marry, we used to talk about, you know, what does it take? We wanted to have children. I mean, we from the beginning, both of us, we wanted children in our home. So what does it take to raise godly children? I knew of two families, and I'm going to call their names because I think they deserve it. The Nettles in Illinois, the Suttons in Alabama. Now, what was common about both of these families was this. They came from different backgrounds. The Nettles, the guy was an executive, a vice president, I think, at Caterpillar, big company in Peoria, Illinois. And he had come, he and his wife had been very worldly, just, you know, right along with everybody else, what they do in big business, corporate world, all that. And they had been converted by the Sutton guy that I'm talking about in the second family. And when they were converted, they bought in wholesale. I mean, everything. This is what God says, so this is what we're doing. Now, he remained an executive in Caterpillar. And he raised, I'm talking about the Nettles guy, he and his wife, they raised six children, and their six children went to public school, and all of, you know, just normal. I mean, nothing out of the ordinary as far as all that goes. But it was what they did in their home. They raised six kids. One of them is a really good friend of mine. And so I know this family very well. And I've asked both him and I've asked his parents, what did you do? And the things that you get out of them are not earth-shattering secrets like we dug up, we found this little secret somewhere. It's not that. We just did what God said. We raised our children. Our children knew, first of all, they knew this is home. And it's going to be home till one of us dies. And it's still going to be home till both of us die. They knew that. And they knew that there was a commitment to them. We brought you into this world and we're committed to you for life. We ain't going anywhere. We're going to be here. But they also knew we expect things out of you. And as we talked to the Suttons down in Alabama, they raised five kids like that. All faithful. And when you look at them now grown, you start to see people who are, you know, maybe one or two of them preach. One of them's an elder. Another one of them's deep. You know, that kind of thing. They're committed, faithful people. And they weren't perfect. For time, you know, at times maybe one of them would go a little astray and get off course and all of that. And the parents dealt with that. My point is, it's not impossible. But what is the value? The value is having, when you look at my friend or you look at the others of my age, both these people are the next generation up, my parents' age. When you look at these people and you look at their lives and now their own children's lives, the difference, man, the difference. How many of us come in here and commiserate with each other, crying on each other's shoulders about our brothers, our sisters, our nieces, our nephews, everybody in the family that has just totally been given to the world and suffering the consequences? I tell you, I know two families whose children and grandchildren and now great-grandchildren are going to be coming soon. They don't. Where's the value in working for a harem like this? Modernists will argue for alternative arrangements. Modernists will tell you it doesn't take that old-fashioned, traditional, classical, biblical. It's outdated. It's just totally outdated. It's time, its day has come and gone. There's a new day. It's 2018. And you know, I've heard it's whatever day it is from as long as I can remember. I remember when it was 1969, man. It's a different day. Well, now it's 50 years later. It's all euphemistic for saying we don't need to do it God's way. We got a better plan. And I'm inclined, if I were going to be sarcastic, to look at the results once you've done it a different way. Look at the results 40, 50 years down the line and say, how's that working for you? Because it's not. God's plan works. If we're going to build an ark and save our sons and our daughters, it is going to be because in our home, we go by God's plan. If you're here today and you're not a child of God, you believe that Jesus is the Son of God. You believe that His way, His plan for everything, salvation of your soul, the establishment of your home, the way you conduct your life every day, that His plan is what you need to obey. If you'll confess He's the Son of God, be willing to repent, be baptized for forgiveness of your sins, your sins will be forgiven. Everything from the past will be washed away. Your day will be completely new. Maybe it is that you've been baptized and your life hasn't been what it needs to be. You have gone astray, like I mentioned earlier, and you need to come back home. If you need to do that, we beg you to come while we stand and sing.